Hi, dear listeners. I just want to remind you that about a month and a half ago, Undisclosed began its Patreon page. We now have our second episode up. It's a bonus episode where Susan Cullen and I talk about the new season of Serial. We go over the first two episodes and we're going to continue to follow it. And in our first episode, we covered the case of Curtis Flowers, the State versus Curtis Flowers, which was featured in the second season of In the Dark, an award-winning podcast. So check out these episodes. Sign up to become a patron today of Undisclosed in order to support our work and also to get some great content. And every month, at least, if not more frequently, we'll be dropping bonus episodes and doing maybe some updates on other cases that we have been covering the last few years. To sign up and become a patron for as little as $5 a month, all you have to do is go to www.patreon, that's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Once again, that's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Thank you so much for your support and for listening.
Like with this case, the Swains case, it's a full circle case for me because I remember the night it happened. There was three crimes that night. The two murders and a stolen vehicle. I was 15 years old. I stole my mom's car to go see a girl who lived maybe a mile from the church through the woods away. And that night, I was at her house and we're sitting there. And I can't remember what day of the week it was. But I was sitting there and everything. And there was a loud knock at the door, at the kitchen door, because the garage door was still up. I swore up and down it was my mother coming because I stole a car. So while we're sitting there and everything, and I'm about to freak out because I'm in a whole bunch of trouble. And then the girl's dad goes and opens the door, and it's one of the church members. Well, she came and she was hollering and screaming, saying the Swains just got killed.
That's Mike Ellerson. In 1985, he was a teenager living down in the southern part of Camden County, closer to the Florida border. By chance, though, on the night the Swains were killed, he'd been at the northern end of the county, in Waverly, just down the road from Rising Daughter Baptist Church. That's where he was when someone from the church came to the door to tell them that the Swains had been murdered and the killer had gotten away.
So I had her dad walk me to my car. Now, I'm 15 years old, about 5'10", 5'11", nothing but muscle, but I'm afraid that there's somebody walking, riding around, killing folks. So I finally get in the car and I about blew up that engine and that Cutlass trying to get home. And because I had stolen the car, I didn't say anything to my grandmother or mom what had happened because I would have gotten in trouble. I didn't say anything. My mom didn't know I took her car for weeks and everything. And then here it is, years later, I'm working at the sheriff's office on the Swains case.
5 years after the Swains were killed, Mike Ellerson joined the Camden County Sheriff's Office, and about 8 years after that, he was given a new assignment. The Swain case was being reopened, and he was being assigned to the team working on it. And so, 13 years after that night when he'd snuck out of his house and driven to his girlfriend's house and learned that there was a killer somewhere out there, it became his job to find out who that killer was. It turned out that being assigned to the Swain case wasn't quite the full circle it had seemed at first, though, because Mike Ellerson would end up walking away from his investigation with more questions and no answers.
And as far as Dennis Perry, I never thought he did it. I'm with Butch Kennedy and Gregory. I never believed he did it. I think I got the court transcripts in the house. I look over it every blue moon just to make sure my mind is still right about it, because I knew one day somebody would question rather Dennis Perry actually did it.
Welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 13 of our series on the State versus Dennis Perry, My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Let's not kid ourselves. You're not sleeping in. There's too much to do. You need to make your sleep count. So you need Boll & Branch sheets. You'll be so comfortable you'll fall asleep faster, sleep deeper, and wake up ready to kick some ass. What makes them unique is each sheet is crafted from 100% organic cotton. That means Boll & Branch sheets not only feel incredible, but also look amazing. And since Boll & Branch sells exclusively online, you don't pay that expensive retail markup. That's half the price for twice the quality. You'll love these sheets. Try them for 30 nights and see for yourself. If you're not impressed, return them for a full refund. Anyone who sleeps on Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. The New York Times, Forbes, and the Wall Street Journal all rave about them, and even three U.S. presidents have Boll & Branch sheets. So go to bollandbranch.com today, and you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free shipping in the U.S. when you use the promo code undisclosed. That's $50 off, plus free U.S. shipping right now at bollandbranch.com. Spelled B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. That's bollandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed.
During that time, most of those guys, you know, Dale Bundy and Daryl and all of them, they're more familiar with it than I am. The only thing is, I was just out there that night. You know, I wasn't supposed to be.
You were nearby, but you couldn't tell anyone at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike Ellerson was a junior law enforcement officer on the case, working under Dale Bundy and a couple other more senior deputies. Unlike Ellerson, most of the other investigators had actually been with the Sheriff's Department at the time the Swains had been killed, and they knew much more about the case's history within the office.
By the time I came about, it was just trying to put everything together, go back over all the evidence, all the reports. And because I'm trying to think exactly when I was called in the office about it. I can't remember what year it was when they started looking at it again.
Ellerson doesn't remember exactly what year it was that he was brought onto the Swain case. And because there was essentially no paperwork created to document the reopened Swain investigation, it's hard to piece together the dates of when anything happened. The only paperwork that exists is a 6-page summary that Bundy later wrote up, and that document mentions Ellerson exactly one time. It says that on July 16, 1998, Ellerson and Bundy had gone to Vinzola Williams' house to interview her. Which means that we know Ellerson was working on the case by no later than July of 1998. And around the same time Ellerson was assigned to the case, either a few weeks before or a few weeks after, he's not exactly sure now, Deputy Dale Bundy had been brought back to the Sheriff's Department and assigned to the case as well.
What was your understanding of why Bundy was there? Or how Bundy got to be there?
As far as working the case?
Yeah.
I think that was an agreement with him and the sheriff to come back to the sheriff's office, was to work that case.
You know, like, how that came about at all?
No. That's way up here on the totem pole of information between small people and big people.
Dealing with the politics of the Swain case was not Mike Ellerson's role. He was just there to investigate.
It was, my part was more or less trying to help piece things together that made sense. It was like getting a younger mind into the equation of the investigating and everything.
By the time Ellerson had joined the team, though, there were really only a few things left that needed to be investigated. Because by that point, the Camden County Sheriff's Department had already answered the most important question about the case. Who had done it?
So when you were brought on, had they identified suspects already?
Yeah, it's Dennis. As Dennis, and they were trying to piece together how he could have done it. You see what I'm saying? It's more or less him being in Atlanta and then making a trip down here and then getting out of here and nobody seeing him.
Ellerson's task had not been so much to investigate what had happened to the Swains, but instead to investigate Dennis Perry.
A couple of times I had to ride over to 9A and look at a trailer in a house where possibly Dennis was staying or something like that. I can't remember how it went, but I know a couple of times I had to ride over there.
To where?
In Jacksonville.
Okay.
In Jacksonville and look for a car to see if a car was at a certain house. And not one time I ever went over there, the car was ever there. I don't know what that was all about. But, you know, when the case started back up and everything, it was all the paperwork that Kennedy and Gregory had done. So I spent a couple of weeks or so just going over.
After reviewing all of the case files from Butch Kennedy and Joe Gregory, though, Mike Ellerson began to question the direction of the investigation. For one thing, Ellerson couldn't remember seeing anything in the paperwork that explained why Dennis Perry was supposedly the guy who had done these murders.
So, do you know why Dennis was identified as a suspect?
From my understanding, because he lived in the area and had some words with Mrs. Swain at some point.
Where did you hear that he had words with Mr. Swain?
It was up at, I want to say, a Reed's Package Store up there. Maybe they were up there one day and they got into an argument or something like that.
Do you remember where how you learned this? Would have been in conversation?
In conversation with Daryl and whoever else.
Did they tell you how they learned this?
No.
I will tell you that's nothing I've ever seen or heard of.
Yeah.
Is that, so are you feel pretty confident that there was discussion of a supposed disagreement between?
I don't believe it.
No. Are you confident that you heard the story?
I heard it. I take my word, I heard it, that they had gotten into an argument. But I don't know when they had gotten into an argument. You see what I'm saying?
The fact that they got into an argument is news to me.
Yeah. That was one thing I definitely remember hearing, is that, yeah, they had gotten into an argument up at Reed's store one time, but I can't remember why they argued. And I don't know who told them that. But that was one thing that was said, you know, amongst us just talking about the case. But that never was enough to say he killed them.
I realized only later that I had completely misheard Mike Ellerson here. What he recalled was not that Dennis Perry had words with Mr. Swain, but that he'd had words with Mrs. Swain. But either way, what Ellerson had told me was not something I'd ever heard before. There is literally not a record anywhere in all the tens of thousands of pages about any kind of argument at the Reed's Package Store. It's just not there. Anywhere. And Ellerson doesn't recall reading about it either. He just recalls talking to the other investigators about it. Actually, from his memory of the case file, Ellerson couldn't remember reading anything about Dennis Perry that made him think Dennis Perry was guilty. If anything, it was the opposite.
So you never really knew why Dennis was chosen?
No.
Because I can't answer that question either.
I have no idea. I don't even... Still, you know, you got some proof that it's almost impossible. If the guy giving him a ride or a supervisor is saying he's here, how in the hell you expect him to be here at 2 or 3 hours later? I've driven from here to Atlanta in a Mustang. I still never got there in 3 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about a 5-speed, me and a friend, and we just busting it with a radar detector. And I never made it to Atlanta in 3 hours.
When Mike Ellerson was assigned to the Swain case, the sheriff's department's already building towards making an arrest of Perry. So Ellerson's job was just to put all the pieces of the case together to help make that happen. The problem was, no matter how hard he tried, he just could not get the pieces to fit the way that they were supposed to.
Like I said, I never once thought Dennis Perry did it. I never once thought he did it.
Did you ever tell that to the other people on the team, or did you bring it up?
That's when I was, once I got finished, And I came to my conclusion that he didn't do it, I was off. I was gone.
Really?
I had nothing else to do with that case.
Mike Ellerson was not on the Swain case for long, and there's a lot about the investigation he was never in a position to know. Because as soon as he reported to Bundy and the other investigators that he thought the evidence did not point towards Dennis Perry, he was off the case.
Yeah, after you told them, they're just gone?
I didn't have anything else to do with that case. I wasn't at the trial. I wasn't there. It's not like I didn't care. I was just pissed. I was pissed because here it is. I told you my opinion on it. Let's test these other avenues and go from there, because I don't believe Dennis Perry did it.
When I'd shown up at Mike Ellerson's doorstep, I'd known next to nothing about him. Like we mentioned earlier, in the scant paperwork that we have from the Camden County Sheriff's Department, Ellerson's name is mentioned only once, in connection with the interview of Venzola Williams. So originally, that's what I was going there to ask him about. This section from Bundy's report.
July 16, 1998, I contacted Ms. Venzola Williams. Ms. Williams was present in Rising Daughters Church when the incident occurred. I interviewed Ms. Williams at her home. Also present was Detective Mike Ellerson.
Okay.
Williams was shown a photograph of Perry. She also identified him as a suspect at the Rising Daughter Church.
This whole interview on July 16th had been an important one because Venzola Williams was one of only two witnesses to identify Dennis Perry as the man who killed the Swains. And Venzola Williams is the witness who had actually encountered the suspect in the vestibule that night, who had actually spoken to them, so she'd gotten the best look of all the witnesses. And at trial, Del Bundy had testified that when he'd gotten to Venzola Williams' house and shown her that photo of Dennis Perry that he'd gotten from Jane Beaver, Venzola had instantly recognized him as the killer. And she told him the same thing that Cora Fisher had said.
I asked Venzola, I says, is the man in that picture the man that killed Harold and Thelma Swain? And she says, unless he has a twin brother.
But Venzola Williams herself gave a different answer on the stand. When shown Jane Beaver's photo of Dennis Perry, she had said that she couldn't be sure if it was the same man she'd seen in that vestibule.
So I knew from Bundy's report that Mike Ellerson had also been here at this interview with Venzola Williams, and I was hoping he might be able to give me his own perspective on how Venzola had reacted when Bundy had shown her the photo. Had she been confident that this photo was the same man she'd seen in the vestibule that night, or had she been less sure? Only, when I asked Ellerson about it, he'd had no idea what I was talking about. He was looking at me like I was the one who was confused. So I pulled up Bundy's report to show him, just to prove to him I wasn't making this up.
So what he says happened is he showed her a photo, and she said that's the killer, and the photo was Dennis Perry.
I'm getting pissed.
Why?
Because I'm sitting here thinking, do I remember going there with him? And I may have, but the picture part, I don't remember. But then again, it was so long ago. If he said I was there, I was there.
I had really been hoping Ellerson might be able to clarify exactly how Venzola Williams had responded to seeing that photo of Dennis Perry, though. So I kept running through the documents with him, what few documents there were, trying to refresh his memory, trying to give him some kind of context for Bundy's report so he could recall what had happened.
And they said that they identified him, but I don't remember being there when they identified him. I really don't. I want to say, if he says I was there, I was there. I don't remember the identifying part, just the talking part.
It has been 20 years since this interview with Venzola Williams took place. And it's possible that, in reality, everything at that interview happened exactly like Bundy's report says it happened. It's possible that Bundy showed Venzola Williams that photo of Dennis Perry that Jane Beaver had given him, and it's possible that Venzola Williams identified the man in the photo as the man who had killed the Swains. It's possible that all that happened, and Ellerson has just forgotten it. But it's also possible that Mike Ellerson's memory is accurate, and it's Bundy's report that's wrong. Because there's someone else who remembers the interview with Venzola Williams happening exactly the same way that Mike Ellerson remembers it. And that's Venzola Williams herself. At both the pretrial hearing and at Dennis's trial, Venzola Williams testified that Bundy had never shown her a photo of Dennis Perry. Here's what she said in August of 2001 about the time Bundy came to interview her.
What did Mr. Bundy say when he came to you that day? And we've been told it was in July 98. I know you don't remember, but what did he say to you that day?
He just said that they were investigating. We're still investigating this case.
Did he ask you any questions?
No, he did not.
Did he show you anything?
No, he did not.
He didn't show you a picture?
No.
Are you positive that, Ms. Williams?
I'm positive.
Is it possible, Ms. Williams, is it possible that you were shown the photograph of Perry that was shown to you by Beaver? Is it possible you were shown the same photograph and you just don't remember?
I don't remember.
Have you ever been shown a photograph after Ms. Beaver?
No, I haven't.
Venzola Williams was asked these questions over and over, and she kept giving the same answer. At trial, the prosecutor portrayed this as just an understandable memory lapse on her part. And maybe that's all it was. But even when, finally, the prosecutor showed her the photo itself in an attempt to refresh her memory of this meeting, she gave the same answer.
Is this the first time you've seen that picture since Ms. Beaver showed it to you?
Right.
So Detective Bundy did not show you that picture?
No.
He didn't show you any pictures of somebody in jail, what we call mugshots?
No.
which means both Mike Ellerson and Vinzola Williams remember this interview the exact same way, that Bundy and Ellerson came to her house to talk to her, but did not show her any photos of Dennis Perry.
Mike Ellerson is willing to give Bundy the benefit of the doubt. If Bundy says that Ellerson was there when Vinzola was shown the photo of Dennis Perry, then Ellerson was there. But at this point, I'm less sure the benefit of the doubt is warranted. If neither Mike Ellerson nor Vinzola Williams recall Vinzola looking at a photo of Dennis Perry during this interview, and if the only record we have that says she was shown a photo comes from a report that Bundy had made only months later, well, I think we have to seriously consider the possibility that Vinzola Williams and Mike Ellerson are right, and Bundy's report is wrong.
But I don't remember him showing a picture. I don't, because I don't remember the picture in my head.
I was going to ask you what photo it was, so... But
yeah, I don't remember the picture.
It was somewhere around then, while sitting out there on Mike Ellerson's porch, watching people mow their lawns and hearing him talk about his work on the swing case, that I first began to realize that something was even more wrong with this case than I'd thought before. By then, I'd already known there were lots of things wrong with the case, yes. But I also thought I knew this case really well. I thought I had a pretty good grasp of what had happened, what had not. I knew who the witnesses were, I knew when they were talked to, I knew why they were talked to. I had thought, in short, that I more or less knew what reality was in this case. But talking to Ellerson, I began to understand. Everything that I thought I knew about this case was wrong. The entire story about how Dennis Perry had been identified and developed as a suspect, it was just that, a story.
I am so excited to talk about one of my favorite sponsors because it's just one of my favorite companies, and that is FabFitFun. And the FabFitFun Fall Editor's Box is here. I got mine a couple of weeks ago. It was amazing. I mean, I have so much fun opening it up. It's like Christmas or my birthday or just something, but me and my girls gather around, we open it up, it's like a whole ceremony, and then we all kind of divide and conquer what's in the box. But here's how it works. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box that's delivered four times a year, and it's got full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products for just $49.99 a box. That's less than 50 bucks, okay? It's a great gift to yourself or to a loved one. If you've got a daughter going to college or a friend who's a new mom, I mean, it's just a really wonderful gift. And like I said, I love it for myself. It's a great care package. So, you know, if there's something, you know, you're looking for like an original gift, something different, I'm telling you, get this box for your whoever it is. One of the things I love about FabFitFun is that they're full-size products. There aren't any samples of anything. Now, here's the thing. I love skincare and beauty products. I buy them all the time, but I'm not going to lie. You know, you buy them from the stores, you end up buying full-size things, and then sometimes you don't like the product, and you have spent a lot of money on that full-size product. Here, with the FabFitFun box, for like a fraction of the cost of what is in that box, you are getting a whole host of things. I'll give you an example. In my box, I got the Elemis Papaya Enzyme Peel. And here's the thing. This peel retails for around $45 just by itself. So the price of that one item, I mean, pretty much is like the covers the price of that box. And the value of the fall box is over $275. But here's the thing. If I had bought that product on its own, spent 45 bucks, let's say I didn't really like it, and then what? But here I get to use it for a fraction of the cost. And by the way, I loved it. My skin feels like almost as smooth as my baby's butt. Feels pretty good. So sign up for FabFitFun today and get your fall editor's box. The FabFitFun fall editor's box is in limited supply and the boxes sell out. Use our code undisclosed to get $10 off your first box. That means it's only going to be $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use the promo code undisclosed. Don't forget to do that because look, when you use our promo codes, you support our sponsors and they support us. Once again, use the promo code undisclosed to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 of products for only $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com and use our promo code undisclosed to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box. A According to how the story of Dennis Perry's conviction is usually told, everything began with unsolved mysteries. A woman named Jane Beaver saw the show and called in a tip about Dennis Perry, but somehow her tip was ignored. It fell through the cracks for nearly a decade. It wasn't until 1998 when Deputy Dale Bundy went up and down US 17 knocking on doors until he came to Jane Beaver's door that this cold case was finally cracked wide open. And this is a story that the jury was told at Dennis Perry's trial. In opening statements, Prosecutor John Johnson said,
"When this was put on Unsolved Mysteries, I don't know how many of you know what happens when a case is on Unsolved Mysteries, but you'll find that when they say, please call this number, people call that number. And in this particular case, there's like 2 5-inch binders of reports that came out when people called, and that information was logged into the computer system, and a computer-generated printout came out, which was returned back to the police officers. Interestingly enough, there were 2 telephone calls that came in on Dennis Perry. Just interesting. And those calls came from a lady, one of them at least, came from a lady named Jane Beaver, and she becomes an important part of this case."
This is the way Dale Bundy remembers things, too. There were tons and tons of tips, he said. Mostly, they were tips that were not worth the dot matrix paper they were printed out on. But then there were also a few tips that were worth quite a bit more.
There were some that had credence to them, and Dennis Perry's name was in those tips.
So I couldn't find that one from... So he was definitely reported in Unsolved Mysteries, do you think?
Yes, okay. Ma'am, he was.
We have copies of the binders that John Johnson was talking about in his opening statement. I've read every single one of those tips. But here's the weird thing. Jane Beaver's name isn't anywhere in there. So I asked Bundy about this, and he told me, yes, there had been multiple witnesses who called in from Unsolved Mysteries, and Jane Beaver was one of them.
Yeah. Let me. Do you think it was more than one, though?
Yes.
Okay. Were there names attached to the tips? I know Jane Beaver said that she'd left her name.
Jane Beaver left her name, and I believe there was another person that left her name, but I'm not sure enough to tell you.
The other person that left their name after calling in an Unsolved Mysteries tip is Corky Rozier. I do have a copy of that tip. Corky is the neighbor that was the very first person to ever name Dennis Perry as a suspect. When, back in 1988, he'd reported a rumor he'd heard about Harold Swain somehow discovering someone's marijuana fields and Dennis Perry somehow being involved in that in some way. But that's the only tip about Dennis Perry in the whole case file. Prior to Bundy writing his 6-page report in 1998, the name of Jane Beaver had not been recorded anywhere. Or, if it had been, any imprint she'd left in the case file had long since blown away before I ever got to it. But when Dale Bundy had had the case file, back in 1998, there must have been some trace of Jane Beaver's involvement there still. Or at least that's how he recalls it. Although, back in 1998, Mike Ellerson probably spent more time with the case records than just about anyone else in the case. And, like me, he never saw Jane Beaver's name in there either.
And then,
you never heard that before, though, about Beaver saying all this stuff?
I more than likely read it.
Okay.
But,
well,
I
don't think you would have, because that report was not made until November. And, well,
I may have read it. Who knows? But as far as all of this, no. No. Answer the door and identify myself. No. I didn't know about she had said something prior to all of this.
At trial, Jane Beaver had told the court that she'd called in tips about Dennis Perry dozens of times. She'd called the sheriff's office, she'd called Unsolved Mysteries. She kept calling and kept trying to get through to them. She testified the reason she kept calling was she had photographs of Dennis Perry that she thought the authorities should see. But for some reason, no one would ever get back to her, so eventually she gave up. Finally, in 1998, when Bundy knocked on her door, she was able to tell him everything, about how she had taken an old photo of Dennis Perry and shown it to some of the church ladies, and they'd identified him as the killer. And about how a few days or weeks before the murders, Dennis Perry had told her that he'd tried to borrow money from Harold Swain, but Harold Swain had laughed at him for it, so now he was going to find out what it felt like to kill a black person. And Jane Beaver also told Bundy about how Dennis Perry did wear glasses, because she'd seen him wearing women's glasses once as a joke.
But Jane Beaver did make a statement that Dennis had had a pair of glasses that he was running around acting silly with. But again, I didn't put any credence in that because I don't know anything about those glasses.
The lady's glasses. Yeah, well, I didn't get that part of her statement. Like, what is...
I don't know. I remember her saying something about the glasses, and that's about how much credence I put on it. I don't have the glasses, can't say, were these the glasses? So
So there's no story there. She just says, like, yeah, Dennis came over as wearing women's glasses. And I didn't know if there's a backstory.
It's not clear how the women's glasses fit into all this. But as for the rest of Jane Beaver's story, well, if it was true, it'd be pretty strong circumstantial evidence that Dennis Perry is guilty. And the jury believed her story. But Jane Beaver's story might not be true. For one thing, it's full of inconsistencies and incompatible with the known timeline of where Dennis Perry was during the weeks before the murders, when she says he made all these incriminating statements to her. But if it's not true, that raises a new question. Why would she have made all this up?
A few weeks ago, back in September, Jane Beaver passed away. She'd had Alzheimer's and had not been in good health for some time, so we never had an opportunity to talk to her or ask her about her testimony at Dennis's trial. And since I couldn't ask her why she'd said the things she'd said, the only other thing I could think to do was to ask her daughter, Carol Ann. Carol Ann and Dennis Perry had dated back in 1985, but they broke up due to distance after Dennis had moved back to Atlanta. And although Carol Ann had testified for the prosecution at Dennis Perry's trial, her testimony had been very different from her mother's testimony. And I wondered, maybe at some point she'd asked, or her mother had explained, why she'd testified the way she had. When I went to Carol Ann's house, at first she wasn't all that interested in talking to me. Besides, she said, she didn't know anything anyway. So our conversation was abrupt, and I got right to the point. I just asked her, do you think that Dennis really said those things to your mother? And Carol Ann said, yes, he did. I was there when he said it. Her answer was confident and very matter-of-fact, and I was shocked because from what I knew of the case file, I'd never seen any indication that Carol Ann had ever corroborated Jane Beaver's story. And now, the first thing she was telling me was, yes, Dennis Perry had said those things, and yes, Carol Ann had heard it too. So I asked Carol Ann more carefully this time, what exactly did Dennis Perry say to your mother? And Carol Ann told me that those ladies' glasses he'd had, he'd said they belonged to his mother. He did say that. I was there, I heard it. Oh. Okay. So I told her, what about the other things Jane Beaver had testified about? About the Swains and borrowing money. Had Dennis really said those things? And Carol Ann's answer was just as confident as before. I didn't hear any of that, no. That's just not something I have any knowledge of, she said. But as for those ladies' glasses that Dennis Perry had, well, that Carol Ann can confirm really had happened. I'm still not really sure what to make of the whole ladies' glasses story. Carol Ann clearly thought they were important to the case. So important that when I showed up at her doorstep asking about Dennis Perry, she had immediately jumped to the conclusion that I was there to ask her about the lady's glasses. And she remembered that whole thing happening clearly enough. At some point, Dennis Perry had been joking around and put on a pair of lady's glasses, and Carol Ann recalled someone making a joke about him possibly being gay. Something like that. And Dennis Perry had said that the glasses had belonged to his mama. Of course, none of that has any relevance to the Swain case, at least as far as I know. The glasses found in the vestibule, they weren't ladies' glasses at all. But it's the only part of Jane Beaver's story that Carol Ann could tell me anything about. So I asked her instead about Dennis Perry. And like everyone else I talked to, she had nothing bad to say about him. She told me a story about how when her son was young and she and Dennis were dating, her son had gone through a period where he refused to eat. And she said that Dennis would sit there with him for hours, just coaxing him to take a bite, and then another. He was patient, she said. Way more patient than I was. And when I asked her if she thought Dennis Perry had killed the Swains, her answer was immediate, no. In fact, she seemed so confident in her answer, I was kind of surprised by it. I asked her how she could know he hadn't done it, and she said, "Have you ever met him? He's a very harmless person. No, I don't think he killed anybody ever. If you talk to him long enough, you'll see. It's just not possible he did this." But if Carol Ann doesn't think Dennis Perry could have killed the Swains, then why would her mother have thought he had? I don't know, Carol Ann told me. She went by the pictures. That's all I know.
I wear Bombas socks every single day. At least I have been for the last, about 6 weeks. That's because I started a new personal training and boot camp regime. And believe me, these are the only socks I would wear to work out for so many reasons. Bombas has totally re-engineered socks with comfort innovations that add up to a way more comfortable pair of socks. They did 2 years of research, okay, and development, and that led to multiple improvements of the sock design, performance, and comfort. One of my favorite things about Bombas socks, and the reason, by the way, that I wear them to work out every single day, is their arch support system. It's this little band. It provides extra support right in the arch of your foot. It's where you need it most. Feels like a little hug around your foot. It's got a cushioned footbed. These socks do not slip. I can jump, I can lunge, I can do whatever, and they stay put. Because they have stay-up technology, 103 tension levels were actually tested to find the perfect tension that's comfortable. They stay in place, never too loose. And by the way, when I finally peel them off, there's no little ridgy mark around my ankle. They've got a seamless toe, no more annoying bump on your toe. Once again, nice and comfortable when you're working out, and they are super soft cotton. Another reason I love Bombas socks is this. For every pair sold, a pair is donated. Now, we are in the fall season. It's gonna get colder and colder, and believe me, socks are the number one most requested item in homeless shelters. But you cannot donate used socks. That's why Bombas donates one brand new pair of socks for every single pair that they sell. You buy a pair of socks, somebody in need is getting a pair of socks. Think about that. To date, they have sold and donated over 9 million pairs. So go to bombas.com/undisclosed. That's bombas.com/undisclosed. And you'll get 20% off your first order. And don't forget, when you place that order, socks will also be donated, okay, for every sock you buy. Go to bombas.com/undisclosed and get 20% off your first order. And don't forget to use the promo code undisclosed on checkout.
When Carol Ann said that Jane Beaver, quote, went by the pictures, what she'd meant is that Jane Beaver's belief in Dennis Perry's guilt had been motivated by a resemblance between a photo of Dennis Perry and a composite image that had been prepared by four of the church ladies. When Carol Ann had dated Dennis Perry, he'd given her some photos of himself, and she had hung on to them even after they'd broken up. They'd ended up at her mother's house, probably in storage somewhere. And when Jane Beaver had seen the composite image of the suspect on TV, she had recognized a resemblance between the composite and Dennis, and found the old photo of Dennis that Carol Ann had kept around. Without the composite image, Dennis Perry would have never been named as a suspect. But not everyone thinks there's such an obvious resemblance between Dennis and the composite. Dennis's friend Clayton Tomlinson, for one, has never understood why this composite image made investigators think that Dennis was the killer.
I was reading that stuff, the stories that were coming out, and they had a picture of an individual, and it was like, well, that is not even close. That is not even close.
When I first started looking into this case, I kind of agreed with Clayton. To the extent I saw any resemblance between the composite and Dennis Perry, it was because the composite was some generic-looking white guy. Clayton Tomlinson's mother, Donna Nash, was interviewed by investigators back in 1999, and she told them something similar.
What we're trying to do is eliminate him as a suspect, although a lot of the evidence...
Well, how are you pinpointing to that boy?
There are a lot of things...
Do you know how many rednecks look like Dennis Perry?
Yeah, I realize that.
Deputy Dale Bundy, however, found the composite image to be very compelling.
There was his picture. Have you seen his picture compared to the composite?
Yeah. I don't think any of them might look like the composite to me. Like, have you seen...
Which composite?
The main one.
The color?
Yeah.
Composite. And it's... You're the only person I've heard say that, because everybody else that looks at it and says, wow.
What I hadn't quite realized when I was talking to Bundy, though, is that by comparing Dennis's picture to the composite, Bundy hadn't meant comparing any picture of Dennis to the composite. What he'd meant was comparing the picture of Dennis to the composite. The picture that Bundy had been given by Jane Beaver. and I hadn't seen the picture yet at all. At the time, I was down in Camden County with Claire Gilbert, Christina Cribbs, and Ed Kostikian from GIP. And that night, after talking to Bundy, we stayed up late going through the boxes and boxes of files. And when we came across a photocopy of an oval-shaped photo of Dennis Perry laying on the floor, propping up his baby brother, we knew that this had to be the photo, Bundy's photo, Jane Beaver's photo.
Oh, here we go. That's the picture. Was it only, was it black and white from the original?
I don't know. This is what we found at the DA's office. Right.
No, it wasn't black and white.
You'll see the original at the Glenn County Courthouse.
It turned out that Claire was wrong when she told us about how we'd see the color photo at Glenn County Courthouse the next day, because we didn't. That's where it should have been. The original photo, the color snapshot that come from Jay Beaver, that was entered as an exhibit at Dennis Perry's trial, which meant it was kept with the court's records over in Glenn County, and not the DA's records in Camden County. But when we got to the Glenn County clerk's office, they wouldn't show us the exhibits. And they later told us that all the exhibits and all the physical evidence had been lost. So we still haven't seen the original oval photo in this case. But we did now have a black and white photocopy of it. So we did what Bundy had suggested. We held it up to compare it to the color composite image.
All right, here is the composite.
Well.
Okay, I can see it more so than other photos. That photo of Dennis does actually look a little more like it.
Well, it's the same. It's relatively the same chin, relatively the same mouth. The eyes are a bit further apart.
Yeah, his eyes are like kind of together, and his eyes are like way far apart.
Yeah.
When you look at the oval cutout photo of Dennis Perry and hold it up beside that color composite that the church ladies had made together, there is an uncanny similarity between the two. I'd been dismissive before of the supposed similarities between Dennis and the composite because in the family photos of Dennis that I'd seen, there just wasn't anything that stood out to me as looking much alike.
But in that one specific photo, with Dennis lying on a living room floor, holding up his laughing baby brother to keep him from toppling over, his face tilted up towards the camera with a half smile, yeah, it looks like the composite. The poses match almost perfectly. The hair is parted in the same place, it covers the ears in the same way. There's a prominent pointy chin and a large nose. The same eyebrows. They look a lot alike. The thing is though, the color composite is only one of the composites in this case. There are five in total. The other four were prepared individually by four of the church witnesses, and none of them by themselves have a resemblance to the color composite. Holding all five composites up side by side, the differences are striking.
Okay, hold that up next to those. And I can kind of, okay, look, I can kind of see a little bit of each one in that face.
But how is that the appropriate
place? But, I mean, this, if you take out this outlier.
Yeah, if you take out Cora Fisher.
You can't get that chin.
You take out Cora Fisher and you never get anything close to Dennis Perry. Without Cora Fisher's Rick Astley.
And these are so similar.
Yeah.
And they're not like the composite.
There are three that are very consistent.
That jaw is like almost square in all three of those. Very flat.
So one of the composites that was made by the witnesses looks like one particular photo of Dennis Perry, but there were four other composite images made that don't look anything like any photo of Dennis Perry. And anyway, it wouldn't matter how many of the composites had a resemblance to however many photos of Dennis Perry, you can't use a composite image as if it were a photograph magically printed out from someone's mind. That's not how composites work.
Because it's just made of building blocks, you know? It's not like a real sketch.
So none of these mean anything, then?
Not really.
I mean, they mean, like, if you want to have a rough way of conveying what someone saw, sure. But they're not any good for, like... They're no good at all for guilt or innocence.
So they're good for ruling out, not ruling in.
Not even that. They're good for just, like, conveying an idea that you can't really express in words. But they're definitely not... Once you have an actual person identified, they're no good for making it more or less likely that they're innocent or guilty.
Unless you're Dennis Perry.
Unless you're Dale Bundy and got this photo of Dennis Perry.
And if you're Dale Bundy and you've got this photo of Dennis Perry, you make sure you use it. It turned out that plenty of people had seen the same side-by-side comparison that Bundy had suggested Susan and the GIP attorneys look at.
Carlton Johnson works at a little convenience store at the little intersection that's the closest thing that Waverly has to a town center. He wasn't a witness in this Wayne case, but Susan and former GIP attorney Christina Cribbs went to see him anyway, because she'd been told if she wanted to hear what the talk around town had been, Carlton was the guy she needed to see.
Well, like I say, I used to work down at that store down there way back when, and like I said, I knew everybody.
Carlton was very clear that he didn't actually know anything about the case. All he knew were the rumors he'd heard, and he certainly wasn't going to vouch for the accuracy of any of it. He just knew what the talk around town had been, not whether any of it was true. But it turned out there was one thing that Carlton did know about the case from his own personal experience, something Christina and Susan had not expected at all.
During the time, after 25 years I'm going by, like I said, Dale Bundy, I was working on the JP's during this time. He come and read a sketch, that little sketch thing I told you about. Then he had a real picture of it, and it was identical.
He came to you?
Yeah.
With a picture?
At Ralph's?
No.
JP's?
I mean, I worked at JP's.
So he brought you a picture of Dennis Perry?
Yeah.
Did you know that it was Dennis Perry from the photo?
No, not from the photo, not from that sketch.
No, from the photo that he had.
Yeah.
And he did he tell you that this was the guy who did it, or what?
No, he didn't tell me that. Yeah, the only thing he showed me, he said, you know who this is? He showed me the picture of it. I said, yeah, that's old Dennis. And he showed me the other picture, and I mean, like I said, that was identical. The way he looked, yeah, the way he looked way back then, and that composite, it was identical.
So apparently, back in the late 90s, Deputy Dale Bundy had been going around town showing random people in Waverly this snapshot of Dennis side by side with a composite. And if Bundy had been trying to make an impact on people's opinions about whether Dennis Perry was the killer or not, it worked. Because Carlton did not recognize Dennis just from the composite image alone. But when Dale Bundy had come in that day showing him the oval photo of Dennis and the composite image side by side, they had seemed to him to be identical.
So Jane Beaver had, according to her daughter Carol Ann, been going by the photos when she thought Dennis Perry was guilty. But that doesn't explain everything, because Jane Beaver had also told the police not just about the photo, but also about a conversation she'd had with Dennis, where he told her of his plans to kill Harold Swain. So where had that come from? And if that part of the story wasn't true, why had Jane Beaver said it? Well, while I was down in Camden County, I did hear one explanation for why Jane Beaver might have said this over and over again.
She was crazy. Certifiable, because she has her own key toward the regional hospital.
She's a nut.
How do you know that?
From everybody that knows her.
That woman is crazy. And everybody around town knew it. Going after people in crazy times.
The people I spoke to didn't mean that Jane Beaver was crazy in the pejorative sense of the word. They meant it more literally, that she had serious mental health-related issues.
But calling someone crazy is an easy claim to make even without any proof. And dismissing a witness as crazy can also be an easy way to dismiss a witness whose story is in conflict with the investigator's case. Also, not everyone in Waverly described Jane Beaver in these terms. Some said they remembered her being vindictive and picking weird fights, or claiming people were picking fights with her, but they didn't describe her as mentally ill, just as kind of a difficult neighbor. And some people remembered her fondly. Greg Reed, who owned the package store next to Jane Beaver's trailer, told Susan that he'd known her well. Ms. Beaver was a good lady, he said, and a good customer. He saw her a lot. And according to Greg Reed, Jane Beaver had been sharp as a tack. He didn't buy any suggestion that she might have been mentally ill. Although, Greg Reed also insisted that he'd never had anything to do with investigating the Swain case, and that he'd never even heard about Jane Beaver going out to talk to Cora Fisher or Venzola Williams. He was pretty adamant. He'd never heard about that. That's something we're still not sure how to make sense of, because Jane Beaver testified at trial that it was Greg Reed who had been responsible for helping track down the church ladies in the first place. So, one of them has to be wrong about that.
I'd heard from enough people, though, who called into question Jane Beaver's state of mind, that I'd wanted to ask Bundy about it. He'd interviewed her on multiple occasions, so he'd had some direct experience in interacting with her. Had he ever noticed anything about Jane Beaver that had matched what others had described to me?
She was a little bit eccentric, but you know, as far as being daffy and crazy, she had no sense of smell and had about 15 cats living in the house with her. So whenever Ron Rhodes and I would go to talk to her, we'd sit out on her porch.
It wasn't that Jane Beaver was normal, exactly. But Bundy saw nothing in Jane Beaver that would lead him to question what she had told him about Dennis Perry.
But you didn't find any reason to question her story?
Anybody lives in a house with 15 cats is a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Let's face it, but that doesn't mean that her story's not credible.
And he's right. The fact that Jane Beaver was a bit eccentric, and the fact that some people in town dismissed her as crazy, isn't evidence of anything. But Dennis Perry's attorneys had heard all the same talk I'd heard, and had the same questions I had about her credibility. So, 3 years after Dennis's arrest, and just weeks before his trial, they finally decided to see if there was some way they might be able to prove that Jane Beaver was not, in fact, a reliable witness.
Ed Clary, Dennis's Georgia-based defense attorney, sent a subpoena to the Georgia Department of Human Resources, and in his cover letter to the department, wrote the following.
Please be advised that this office is representing Dennis A. Perry, who is the defendant in a capital murder case, which is scheduled to go on trial on the third day of February 2003. It has recently come to my attention that Mrs. Jane Beaver, a key prosecution witness, has had numerous mental health problems which have resulted in her being hospitalized in the state of Georgia on several occasions. I am therefore enclosing a subpoena duces tecum asking that you voluntarily produce any and all medical records resulting from Mrs. Jane Beaver's hospitalization.
1 month later, on January 23, 2003, an assistant attorney general for the state of Georgia finally wrote back on behalf of the Department of Human Resources.
My clients, the Georgia Department of Human Resources, have received the subpoena duces tecum that you sent requesting medical and mental health records regarding Jane Beaver for a criminal trial set for February 3, 2003. The DHR is not the custodian of medical and mental health records regarding Jane Beaver. Please note that if Ms. Beaver had received services at a state hospital, under Georgia law, as well as federal law, DHR could not produce such records because they are confidential and are not subject to discovery, except as set out in those statutes.
This letter was sent to Dennis's attorneys, but it was also sent to the prosecutors. We know that because a copy of it was found in the DA's file. Only on the DA's copy, there are some handwritten notes. Scribbled in the top corner is a brief message.
State does not have these records. Facility owns records.
The facility meaning a private contractor used by the state to provide mental health care services. They're the ones who had any records, not the state of Georgia. On February 3rd, 2003, the same day that Dennis Perry's trial was scheduled to begin, Dennis's defense attorneys filed a revised extraordinary motion for discovery seeking to compel the production of Jane Beaver's health records. In their motion, Dennis's defense attorneys wrote,
Jane Beaver is a key witness with the state in this action, claiming to have heard the defendant make statements which might lead to an impartial trier of the facts to conclude that the defendant was somehow involved in the murder of Mr. and Mrs. Harold Swain. Thus, the mental and emotional health of Jane Beaver is of crucial importance in the maintenance and presentation of the defendant's case in this matter. Jane Beaver has had an extraordinary amount of bad luck in her life, to include the suicide of a teenage child, the murder of another child, the suicide of a spouse, etc., all of which could well work to the detriment of her mental and emotional health. Jane Beaver is known and referred to by friends and family members as Crazy Jane, manifesting a reputation for mental and emotional instability.
The DHR, in its response to Dennis Perry's motion, noted it simply was not the custodian of any records related to Jane Beaver's medical treatment, and so, with one exception, it had nothing it could produce. But it did include a one-page document it had found somewhere in its records, and it says,
Jane C. Beaver. Date of birth, June 23, 1939. White female, had one episode in MHM RIS systems, starting February 28, 1990, and ending May 3, 1990. Service was a Gateway Community Service Board. The diagnosis, per your request, adjustment disorder with physical complications.
There's nothing else in this sheet, not the name of who prepared it, and not the date when it was prepared. There's also not really any indication of why it was prepared, with the exception of a stray clause in the last line, quote, the diagnosis, per your request. But per whose request, it doesn't say. Which means an unknown person with the Georgia Department of Human Resources was requested by an unknown person, for unknown reasons, to prepare a short document describing how Jane Beaver had in 1990 been diagnosed with adjustment disorder and briefly received outpatient healthcare services. And this was the one and only document about Jane Beaver that had ever come into the possession of the state of Georgia about the healthcare services that Jane Beaver had received. We still don't know how or why this one document could have come into existence, but it was a fortunate stroke of luck for the prosecution. because the document shows that Jane Beaver had received mental health care services, but only briefly, and not for any condition that could even theoretically impact her credibility. In fact, you can tell the DAA was sure to look that up, because in the DA's files, there are also photocopies from the DSM-IV, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which was used by mental health care practitioners to provide a standardized set of definitions for various psychiatric conditions. The pages from the DA's files are from the chapter of the DSM-IV on adjustment disorders, which is described as this.
The essential feature of an adjustment disorder is the development of clinically significant emotional or behavioral symptoms in response to an identifiable psychosocial stressor or stressors.
In other words, to grossly oversimplify things, an adjustment disorder is when something bad or stressful happens to you, and you have a harder time than usual in adjusting to the change. It's a diagnosis you give when someone is having a hard time coping, but you don't have anything else in particular that you could diagnose them with. According to the DSM-IV,
adjustment disorder is a residual category used to describe presentations that are a response to an identifiable stressor and that do not meet the criteria for another specific Access 1 disorder.
So according to that one sheet of paper that the state of Georgia happened to have in its possession, Jane Beaver had been treated briefly for a relatively mild mental health condition caused by something stressful in her life. Nothing that could provide any basis whatsoever for calling into question her credibility. Which presumably is why, at trial, the defense didn't seriously call Jane Beaver's credibility into question.
They tried to make her sound like a nut, but Jane Beaver tore him up in the trial.
Bundy is right, I think, about how Jane Beaver did in her testimony. I wish I could hear the audio for myself, but from all accounts, Jane Beaver came off as a powerful and credible witness. And it seems like the prosecution thought the same. In the DA's file, there are a couple of handwritten notes tucked in there. There are no names on it, but from context, it seems pretty clear what they are. They're notes passed back and forth between the prosecutors, right after John Johnson had finished his direct examination of Jane Beaver. And the very last question he'd asked Jane Beaver was about the statements Dennis Perry had made about how he'd always wanted to find out what it was like to kill a black person. The first prosecutor had written on the loose sheet of paper,
"What impact did that statement of Perry's have?"
There are multiple question marks at the end, and the prosecutor must have passed it on to someone else, because written below that, in different handwriting, you can see a second prosecutor's answer.
"It hung in the air like thick fog. Her pause before answering increased its drama. I really think it woke the jury up."
And below that, in the same handwriting, a comment on how defense attorney Dale Wessling's cross-examination of Jane Beaver was going.
"He really is not coming across as very patient with Miss Beaver. She's holding up well."
And below that, there's a final scribbled note.
"P.S. After Perry's statements, the jury except two all of the defendant with a hint of shock and disgust."
At trial, there were no references to any potential mental health conditions that Jane Beaver may have had, which is unsurprising. If records of Jane Beaver's psychiatric history only consisted of that single brief page showing she had once received a diagnosis of adjustment disorder, then there was nothing relevant to be brought up. But those are not the only records of Jane Beaver's psychiatric history. There are more filed under seal with the court. We don't know what's in them, but we do have notes that someone in the DA's office made about whatever is in those records. In the DA's file, on the defendant's notice setting a hearing on the extraordinary motion to compel discovery of Jane Beaver's health records, there are handwritten notes scattered about the page. And in the top left corner, under the name of the attorney representing the Georgia Department of Health, someone has written,
"Suffered from delusional problems, hallucinations, paranoia."
Next to that are two more words. The first is fanciful, but the second is harder to read. It says fanciful spin, maybe? Or fanciful spree? Below that, the handwritten notes continue.
"Miss Beaver does not want this recorded. Filed under seal. Copies to us with instructions."
Judge Amanda Williams, the judge at Dennis's trial, was supposed to review these records in camera on the day of Dennis Perry's trial. That is, she was to review them without the documents first being disclosed to the parties. But because Dennis Perry's trial was only partially transcribed, we don't actually know any of the rulings she may have made in regard to these records. All we do know is that ultimately, none of this came up at trial. But someone in the DA's office seems to have been given further information about the nature of Jane Beaver's mental health history. Delusions, hallucinations, paranoia, fanciful thinking. What's described in these notes in the DA's files would not describe an adjustment disorder. It describes something more serious. Something that could potentially have been relevant to the jury's evaluation of Jane Beaver's testimony. The fact that Jane Beaver may have had a psychiatric history in no way meant she wasn't able to credibly testify at Dennis Perry's trial. We don't know when she had these symptoms, or why she had them, or how long she'd had them for. Without access to Jane Beaver's medical records, we just can't evaluate what impact, if any, this could potentially have had in her role in Dennis Perry's conviction. What the notes in the DA's files do provide, though, are hints that the story that was presented at Dennis Perry's trial might have had an incomplete and fragmented version of the story, and there might be good explanations for why Jane Beaver would have told a story about Dennis Perry that wasn't true.
Carol Ann can't explain why her mother testified that Dennis Perry had told her he planned to kill a black man. She doesn't know. But at the same time, I wanted to understand how it was that she seemed to be able to hold two ideas at once that, to me, appeared to be in direct conflict. First, that her mother was in no way a liar, and second, that Dennis Perry was in no way a murderer. I asked Carol Ann about this, trying to understand how she could both be so certain of Dennis's innocence, but also be just as adamant that her mother had not lied. And Carol Ann told me simply that she and her mother didn't always see things the same way, but she felt that her mother would have been truthful about whatever she said at Dennis Perry's trial. But Carol Ann also thinks that, at times, her mother may have misunderstood or misperceived things. And as we were talking, she told me a story about a time that she and Dennis had been over at her mother's house one day over in Brunswick. Carol Ann didn't recall the full context of the conversation and can't recall the exact language that was used. But she remembered that Dennis Perry had made some kind of comment along the lines of, "I could kill him for that," or, "I'm gonna kill him." And Jane Beaver had freaked out. She was yelling, upset, ordering him to leave. Carol Ann told me, she told me to get him out of here. Actually, get him the hell out of here, she said to us. So we got in the car and left. She thought if someone says they're going to kill somebody, they mean it. And then Carol Ann had added, kind of laughing, "But I say that all the time, just playing around. I don't mean it." The way Carol Ann described this story to me, Dennis Perry had said something like, "I'll kill him," in the normal figure of speech kind of way, like we've all said one time or another. But why had Jane Beaver been so badly upset by that? I asked Carol Ann, could Dennis have meant it? Seriously? Like, could his tone have implied that he was literally planning to kill someone? "No, no, no," Carol Ann said. "I've never seen Dennis be violent. It wasn't something he'd meant seriously." But Jane Beaver's reaction to what Dennis had said had been extreme and immediate. She'd kicked Dennis and Carol Ann out of the house, angry about how Dennis could potentially kill someone. To her, it was a literal threat to commit violence, and she'd responded accordingly. As Carol Ann told me more about Jane Beaver, it was hard not to see possible context for the page of notes in the DA's file. Delusions, hallucinations, paranoia. She had believed, apparently, that she'd been the target of government conspiracies, that her phone had been bugged by some government agency, or that a child's death had not been a tragic suicide, but a murder plot and a cover-up, or that when she left the house, she was being followed. And what Carol Ann was describing fit with so much else that I'd read and heard about Jane Beaver, but had struggled to make sense of. Like how Jane Beaver had told Cora Fisher that her daughter had had a child with the man in the oval photo, when that definitely was not the case. Or about how Jane Beaver had told Dale Bundy that Harold Swain was a drug dealer, when that also definitely was not the case. Or how Jane Beaver had claimed that after Dennis Perry's arrest, Dennis's little brother Shane had been harassing her and stalking her, making threatening calls, when there was no evidence whatsoever to show that any of that had happened. All these little pieces kept pointing at the possibility that Jane Beaver may not have been a reliable narrator for the events in her life. And the more I've learned about Jane Beaver, the more I've wondered about what might have happened in Dennis Perry's trial if the jury had been told some of the same things that I've been told. And if they had heard that, would they have so easily found Jane Beaver's story to be believable beyond any reasonable doubt? Would they still have looked at Dennis with visible shock and disgust? Or would they perhaps have taken a second look at Jane Beaver's claims and given a more careful consideration to the contradictions in her story?
These are very complicated issues, and the question of if and when records of a witness's mental health history should be admissible doesn't always have a clear-cut answer. But at the same time, the state of Georgia was using Jane Beaver's story in an effort to have Dennis Perry executed. The invasion of Jane Beaver's medical privacy is also a very serious factor to be considered, but when weighed against Dennis's life, there are also strong arguments to be made that evidence concerning Jane Beaver's ability to know and comprehend the truth is something the jury should have been able to factor into their evaluation of the factual record.
And there was one more thing Carol Ann told Susan about Jane Beaver that might be equally relevant to answering the question of why Jane Beaver might have told the story about Dennis Perry. Carol Ann said that Jane Beaver, quote, went by the pictures in believing Dennis Perry was guilty, and that after seeing a TV show of the Swain case, she thought Dennis's photo had looked like the composite sketch of the killer, and that had motivated her to take the photo of Dennis Perry around the church ladies and to call in a tip to the sheriff's department. But Carol Ann also said that this TV show that Jane Beaver had seen had told her there was a reward being offered to anyone who helped solve the Swain case. The official story of this case is that Jane Beaver called in a tip after watching Unsolved Mysteries. But on Unsolved Mysteries episodes of the Swain case, there was never any reward offered. So if Carol Ann was right, if Jane Beaver's story was prompted by a TV show that announced there was a reward to anyone with info that could solve the case, then Unsolved Mysteries is not the show Jane Beaver saw. There must have been some other TV show that Jane Beaver had seen and that had prompted her to find Dennis Perry's photo and go show it to the church ladies. There was a TV show that had told Jane Beaver that if she solved the Swain case, she would get a reward. In fact, she'd get $25,000. Next time on Undisclosed.
And that's all for episode 13 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Dennis Perry. There's an addendum this Thursday, so send us your questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. And we'll be back on Monday with episode 14. Methil Tellehan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, and the host of the Crime Writers On podcast. You can find case-related materials on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. Transcripts of this episode and previous episodes will be available on our website, prepared by our transcribing team, Britta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logus, and Skylar Park. Huge thanks goes out to GIP for their work on this case, especially to Ed Kostikian, who was an intern at GIP last summer. And thanks so much to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On all social media, our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners have information on Dennis Perry's case that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message at 410-205-5563.